Hello, and welcome to Community Conversations. Community Conversations is a series of recorded interviews lasting 30 to 40 minutes and played here on KRFY 88.5 FM at 8 a.m. on Tuesdays and Thursdays. This interim show is a temporary alternative to the KRFY morning show. We will bring you topics of current interest, highlighting voices from our community. Please bear with us for any pauses or glitches caused by internet or Zoom connections. And finally, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that it is broadcast. This is your morning show and now Community Conversations host, Julie Calamine, normally joined by Phil Huff, but Phil is away. And our topic this morning is an interview with Xerces Society, talking about pollinators in the Pacific Northwest and also the Atlas Bumblebee Project. And my guest this morning is Rich Hatfield, and Rich has a long title. Rich is Senior Conservation Biologist, Endangered Species Program, Red List Authority, IUCN Bumblebee Specialist Group. Hello, Rich.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for joining us. We normally have folks from within the community or generally around the community, but you're from a little further out. You're from Portland, aren't you?
Yep, that's my home base.
Yeah, and you do a lot of work. Well, I think what I would like to do is have you tell us a bit about yourself and the work that you do, your education, et cetera, but I feel like I need a definition of the IUCN Bumblebee Specialist Group before we go any further. Who and what is that organization?
So my actual just title for Xerces is I'm a senior conservation biologist for the Endangered Species Program. But I'm also the Red List Authority for the IUCN Bumblebee Specialist Group. And the IUCN is the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And their role is to assess the extinction risk of all animals and plants on the planet. That's sort of their mission statement. And as the Red List Authority for the Bumblebee Specialist Group, my role is to assess the extinction risk of all the bumblebees in the world, actually. So there's around 250 species. We've been working mostly in the Americas over the last several years and now trying to shift our focus into Asia and Europe.
That's a lot. That's a big organization. Wow. And they've been around for a while. They're from Great Britain, I believe.
That's correct. Yeah, that's where they're offices are based, although they're obviously collaborating with scientists all over the world.
All right. That's a big job. Well, tell us a bit about you. How did you do to come to be doing the work you're doing now with Xerces?
That's a good question. I sort of graduated from college bright-eyed and bushy-tailed with the desire to change the world. And I didn't really know how I was going to do that. I think as most 22-year-old individuals don't, but I knew that I wanted to and just sort of started exploring conservation biology as a profession. And through some volunteer work and getting to collaborate with a bunch of incredible scientists, Claire Kremen is one and Dr. Robin Thorpe is another one, was exposed to bees sort of before they were cool. At that time, I really saw sort of more of the political side of it, to be honest with you, and that we, at that time, scientists were just starting to put a dollar value on the ecosystem service that bumblebees and other pollinators were providing. And, you know, I sort of recognized that if I was going to go advocate for change in a particular area, that being able to speak to politicians with dollars and cents made more reasoning ability, or I'd have more reasoning ability there than I would by just talking about pretty animals or important ecology. And so that was sort of the inside that I saw. But then after, you know, I went to graduate school and got my master's degree in conservation biology at San Francisco State, studying the bumblebees of the Sierra at that time. And, you know, over those couple of years of working with those animals, just sort of fell in love with them and, you know, became really passionate about working towards their conservation. And then, you know, shortly after graduate school, I fell in love and moved around the country a bunch. And I was actually a high school teacher for around 10 years. So I taught high school math and science. And then interestingly enough, I had connected with the Xerces Society while I was in graduate school, and sort of it had always been a dream. And when my wife finished her training, we ended up in Portland and matched up to work at the Xerces Society. And I've been there for close to 9 years now, working almost full time on bumblebee conservation. And, you know, that can mean a whole host of things on any given day. But I suppose we'll get into a lot of that as we move forward.
I'm certain that we will. So we know your work, it's with bumblebees and studying and understanding just how in danger they are or how healthy they are. And I, as my own science project, 15 minutes ago before our interview started, I went out into my yard and I have lots of bee and bumblebee attractant flowers. I've got lavender and I have bee balm and I have borage. I just have lots of things that the bees like to come to. And mostly I had honeybees because we have a neighbor with honeybees, but I also had three different kinds of bumblebees and what looked like some wasps and even a hornet on the flowers. So that leads me into the next basically conversation, which is many of us think of pollinators just as bees, honeybees and bumblebees, but there's lots of pollinators. So let's just talk briefly about pollinators in the area before we focus in on only bumblebees.
Yeah, that sounds good. Did you have a specific question or do you just want me to start talking?
Well, just about what else, we know bumblebees and honeybees pollinate, but what pollinates our flowers and our fruits? It's not only bees.
No, it's not only bees. Pretty much any animal that visits a flower, you know, can be a pollinator. And we usually think about six main groups of insect pollinators. Here in North America, insects do a vast majority of the pollination services. There are some hummingbirds and other birds that are pollinators. And as the further south you get into sort of Mesoamerica and maybe the desert southwest, there are some frugivorous bats that are also pollinators. But here in our neck of the woods, it's pretty much insects and a couple of birds that are doing pollinators. And there are also some, you know, primates and other animals in the tropics that are pollinators. But here it's pretty much just insects and birds. And not to discount birds, but I am an invertebrate biologist, so focusing on them. There are really six groups of pollinators that are insects: beetles, wasps, bees, flies, moths, and butterflies. And you know, most of those five of those groups, so besides bees, most of those other animals are what we call sort of accidental pollinators. So when they visit a flower, they're actually just there for the nectar. And they might happen to collect some pollen on their bodies while they're there and then transfer that to another flower. But bees are the reason that we think of bees as pollinators, and a lot of people only think about bees, is because they really are the best of the pollinators, and that's because they collect and eat pollen. That's basically their job. That's their only source of protein, and so they're collecting pollen, eating that pollen, and they also lay their eggs on that pollen, and that's what their larvae eat when they're developing. So they're actually intentionally covering their bodies in pollen and moving it through the landscape, and that really makes them highly efficient pollinators, whereas those other animals, they're really just in it for the sugar, and they might happen to move some pollen around, but in most cases, not a lot of pollen.
Yeah, makes sense. So yeah. So we won't trouble ourselves with all those incidental pollinators, and let's move on to bumblebees. Bumblebees, according to my reading, and it's from your site, so it should be right, 33 species and three of great concern, and I saw four, and I imagine, you know, none of those were of great concern, but let's talk a little bit about that, all the bumblebees in the Pacific Northwest, and why are the three of great concern?
Yeah, just stepping back a little bit, we have around 50 species in North America, so to have 33 here in the Pacific Northwest is pretty special. We're in a pretty unique biodiversity, you know, system where, you know, between sort of where I am towards the coast and where you are in the Rockies, you know, there are a ton of different habitats between coastal and high elevation and desert and tropical, or not tropical, but temperate rainforest. You know, we run the gamut, and that has led to, you know, some pretty cool speciation. So we're uniquely situated to get to see a lot of animals in a pretty small area. You know, why are some species threatened and others not so much? That's an interesting question and a troubling one in some ways, just because if you sort of think about bumblebees as a group, you would imagine that if there was something impacting some of them, it should be affecting all of them. But we don't see that when we look on the landscape. Some species seem to be doing better than others. And so, you know, what is it about those particular species? So that's a good question. The major factors for decline, I'm sorry, were you going to say something? Or?
No, I just was agreeing. I mean, we have things like habitat and pesticides and herbicides that kill their food, all kinds of things. So you go on, but I was thinking of the many things that could be causing declines.
Yeah, the main factors are really habitat loss. So, you know, the loss of available food plants. And then sometimes those food plants that are there are treated with insecticides, and those insecticides are certainly having an impact. Climate change is another major issue, as sort of flowers and bees get out of sync in terms of when they can eat and what food is available, and seasons seem to be shortening, which has impacts on bumblebees. But all of those factors you would expect to sort of have pretty equal impacts across species. And so the one sort of factor that we think is having a unique contribution towards these declines is actually disease. So there's some pathogens that are in the bumblebee world, and some species seem to be more susceptible than others. But what's believed, at least for some species, is that commercial bumblebees, which are used for greenhouse pollination and sometimes open field pollination for like blueberries and cranberries, those bumblebees, you can actually buy boxes of bumblebees from companies. They sell them and ship them in a box to your house, and you can put that box, you know, in your farm wherever you want pollination services. And it's believed that in the mid-1990s, some of those animals that were distributed were actually spreading pathogens around North America that were, you know, and sort of amplifying them, taking these pathogens and sending huge concentrations out into regions where they weren't before. And so species that had never dealt with some of these issues before, didn't have resistance to these pathogens, were hit pretty hard by them. And that's believed to be the cause of the declines for a couple of these species. But you also have to imagine that all these factors aren't acting alone, right? Climate change compacted with pesticides, and then you throw disease on top of it, and you have a stressed animal that just can't handle, you know, all of the things that we're throwing at them, and it becomes kind of a straw that breaks the camel's back scenario.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. It's happening all over the world. We know it's a problem with our wildlife, so I totally can see how that would be a problem. And the world will be working on it, hopefully, but part of that is to study them. And you have a study. It's the Atlas Bumblebee Project. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, all of these issues, like the species we have in decline, at the Xerces Society, a lot of our mission statement is to protect invertebrates and their habitat. And so we get a lot of organizations, for instance, the Idaho Department of Fish and Game will reach out to us for recommendations about how do we create habitat to protect and conserve pollinators or bumblebees or what have you, or butterflies. And, you know, our role as a NGO agency is to help make those recommendations and help make science actionable. And so what we have done is tried to take some of the evidence that's out there and help these land managers decide what different flowers to plant, where to plant them, and how often to plant them, and all of these different land management things, as well as how to manage that land. How often should we be mowing and burning and doing all these things that land managers do? But in order to make these recommendations to benefit all species, we need evidence. And when we really started diving into trying to conserve bumblebees and help these struggling species recover, we realized we didn't know a whole lot about their life histories. And so we're setting out through this Atlas project to gather more information about these rare bumblebees, so that when we create habitat, we're not just making common species more common. we need to help these less common species recover and return to how abundant they used to be. So that's really the goal of the Atlas Project, is to gather more evidence so that we can make better recommendations, so that we can be supporting all species of bumblebees and all species of pollinators really on the landscape. That's the ultimate goal.
So how do you go about that? How do you figure out what the rare, the threatened, or species of concern need?
Yeah, the most important thing is we need to find those animals, right? Which is really looking for a needle in a haystack. Idaho, Oregon, and Washington are huge states, and it's hard to look everywhere for them. So what we have done is we've divided those states up into equal area grid cells. And those grid cells are actually pretty large. They're around 50 kilometers by 50 kilometers. And we're recruiting volunteers. We're calling them community scientists to get involved in this project, to adopt a grid cell. And we've developed protocols and resources to help people participate. So we're training people, and they're heading out on the landscape, in some cases in their backyards, or more importantly, they're heading out into some of the wild natural areas that haven't been that well surveyed historically, so that we can find these animals, learn which habitats they're associated with, which flowers they're using, and how abundant they are, and what other species they're found with. So at this point, we've got around 600 to 700 volunteers that are out, on a pretty regular basis collecting data for us, which is fantastic.
And it's multi-year? It's going on and on?
Correct. Yeah, we're in the third year of the project right now. We're hoping this is sort of the end of phase one. We'll end at the end of this season, but we're hoping to continue the project really into perpetuity. But at least we've sort of put some proposals together to take some next steps. This is kind of an aside because it's different, but an interesting thing that we're actually not even getting at with this Atlas project is where queens spend the winter time. So queen bumblebees, the life history of a bumblebee is annual. They live for 1 year, and for half of the year, they're sort of out on the landscape as we see them flying around collecting pollen and trying to rear young and lay eggs. But for half of the year, they're hibernating, and we don't even know where they do that. So we basically don't know a lot about half of the life cycle of many of these species. We have no idea where they even are. And so the next phase is to hopefully try to tackle some of those ideas and learn more about that part of the life cycle.
I suppose that involves some very tiny technology. Are you using some form of GPS system or not?
Those systems exist. They're very expensive though. And you can imagine that even if you put a little piece of GPS on a bumblebee, that it affects their ability to fly around and adds quite a bit of weight to them. So we're not using that. We're just going to rely on person power and trying to get people on the landscape looking for these things. We've got enough people out now paying attention, which is, gosh, half the battle, really, of just getting people paying attention to what's around them. It's such an important thing. So.
Absolutely. Well, you're in Portland, and we're here in Sandpoint. Are there Atlas Bee helpers in our area?
Yeah, I did a training actually up in your neck of the woods a couple of years ago. It was incredibly well attended, and I have a lot of volunteers in that part of this of Idaho, which has been great. And to be honest with you, a little unexpected when Michael Lucid invited me out there to do a training a couple of years ago, and I was like, really? You think we're going to get people? He's like, oh yeah, no problem. And I was like, great. So I came, and yeah, we had a full house, and data has been pouring in from that part. I mean, that doesn't mean that if someone who's just hearing about it now can't get involved, we could certainly use more help. But yeah, we've had great response from that part of the world, which has been fantastic.
That is exactly where I was going with that question. And I was hoping you would offer contact information to listeners in case they would like to join in. Even though the study is underway, I'm sure you can always use more helpers. How would they reach you or Xerces if listeners wanted to become part of this?
Yeah, the best thing to do is to go to our website, which is pnwbumblebeeatlas.org. There's a lot of information there, and including, you can see a map there that shows where we need the most help at this point. So even if you live locally, but you're going on vacation in Southern Idaho or Washington or Oregon, there are lots of regions that we need help. So, even if it's not in your backyard. We're encouraging people to travel, as is safe during the current health environment. Obviously, we don't want people to threaten themselves or other communities, and to really listen to health professionals as they move about. But there certainly are opportunities, and the website's the best place to do that. If they want to get in touch with me directly, my email address is rich.hatfield@xerces.org. And Xerces is X-E-R-C-E-S.
.org. Very good. Yeah. Thank you for offering that. We've talked about one way that people, listeners from our area and other areas, can help learn about bumblebees, but what if you live in either a city or a rural area and would like to foster more bumblebee habitat? What's a good way to get started with that? Or is there a resource? Would it also be your website?
I mean, the best thing that people can do is to stop using insecticides, first of all, and also to just plant flowers. And you know, for bumblebees, they're generalists. They don't need real sort of, a lot of them don't need real specific foods, but we do have plant lists that are available for bumblebees, and you can find those at xerces.org. We have a resource center there that's broken up by region of the country with plant lists to really, so one of the important things about the plant list is getting at what I was talking about earlier, is making sure we're getting a diversity of plants on the landscape, so we're supporting a diversity of species. And just because, as you mentioned at the beginning here, you know, it's not just bees, we're also talking about butterflies and moths as pollinators. And they need plants, they need native plants to complete their life cycle. So a lot of their caterpillars will only eat one species of flower or one genus of plant. So making sure we're using native plants to support those Lepidoptera and other animals that need those plants for their entire life cycle is also really, really, really important. So getting shelter and food and stopping using insecticides are really the best thing that people can do.
Go native plants. 100% agree with that. And are all insecticides pretty much a bad idea? Because we've heard so much about the neonicotinoids. I think I pronounced it correctly.
Yeah, you did. You did well. They're tools that you can have in your toolbox. I think the important piece is we want to bring the education back into it. And so what the neonicotinoids have done is they're systemic and broad spectrum. So you can basically apply it and forget it, even if you don't, you can sort of apply it even before you have a pest. And what we're really encouraging people to do is to pay attention to their plants. And if you have a problem, usually a chemical isn't the solution to that problem. It means something's wrong with your system. And so this is what gardeners do, is you can add different plants or change locations of plants to change the system. And then once you get the system in balance, it should pretty much take care of itself. We don't need insecticides in meadows, right? In mountain meadows, and those systems work pretty well. So it's really, you know, use it as a opportunity to be creative in your garden. I mean, a lot of people want to be able to set it and forget it, but we really need these gardens to be functional ecosystems and not just pretty, or we need to change the definition of what pretty is. And so, yeah, certainly. Yes. I think in ornamental landscapes, we're really discouraging the use of insecticides. They are pretty unnecessary. And there are non-toxic methods available, you know, oils and even water. Soapy water can be a great deterrent for some insects. So seek alternatives.
I agree. And, you know, my messy but very flowery and blooming native and non-native plant garden, to me, is more beautiful with the bumblebees and honeybees and butterflies enjoying it, more so than if it were just a plant here, a plant there, and not much else happening. So I am really on board with you there. So I would like to ask a question about other ways listeners might help. If they're not a, say they're not a gardener, they maybe can't do the bumblebee study. I imagine they could donate or do some other helpful item for Xerces or bumblebees in general. Any ideas?
Yes, certainly. You know, we are a member supported organization, and all donations are incredibly helpful. But I think just to push back a little bit there, I think one of the great things about pollinator conservation is there is actually something that you can do, no matter where you live. Even if you live you know, at a, on a 4-story apartment building or a 15-story apartment building, you can put a pot of flowers on your patio, and that tiny little bit of bees will find it, and they will use it pretty much wherever they are. So I would encourage people to, even if they can't, put out a complete habitat that has tons of food for animals, you know, even every, if we all put a little bit out there, it will make a difference. And so it's different than like a conserve the polar bears thing, where you sort of just have to hope that something good is going to happen. Everybody can make a difference here, even if it's just a pot of flowers on their patio. So I would encourage everybody to do that. But donating to Xerces is also a great thing to do. And there are local organizations, I'm sure, as well. And you, I'm sure you can provide links to those that are also helping this.
We can. Our Bonner County Gardeners Association is one of them. Yeah, I'm happy that you mentioned that everyone can do something. It isn't like the polar bear. We don't have to preserve an entire continent in order to keep them going. And my sort of concluding question to you was going to be that with all the pessimism around species and problems, environment, pesticides, et cetera, there's plenty of room for pessimism, but what keeps you optimistic?
I think being able to have a project like this, where I've been able to engage and interact directly and now indirectly in a virtual world with so many people that have become passionate about this issue, has given me hope. It is, if you just sit in your office and read the news and don't get out into the world and interact with people, it can certainly be a doomy and gloomy place. But you know, when I meet and talk to people that are out doing this and getting excited about it, I know that good change is happening out there. And the other thing that is wonderful is when you get out to big, remote, open places, our earth is still breathing. It is still working in some places. And it is wonderful to visit those places. And I think the Bumblebee Atlas Project gives people opportunity to visit some of those places. And restore some of the faith that we can make a difference and help the earth continue to breathe. And I think those things give me hope. And then I have 2 young kids in my house, and watching them grow up to be, you know, interested and engaged and active people in the world also gives me hope that we're raising the next generation of people that are gonna make this place that we live better.
And care enough and notice that it needs caring for. That's great. Yeah. Well, what a great way to end our conversation today. And if you would, one more time, give us your contact information, at least the website, and then I'll conclude.
Yeah, it's PNW, Bumblebee, all one word, atlas.org.
Very good. Well,
and if you just did like a URL or a web search for Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas, it would pop up as well.
Oh, very good. If people aren't carrying their pencils with them today.
Yeah.
Rich Hatfield, Senior Conservation Biologist for Xerces Society. I want to thank you for joining us here at KRFY today. It's been a great conversation. Wish we had more time, but we're limiting these ones to about half an hour, so we don't get as much accomplished as we did pre-COVID. But nonetheless, we've had great information and lots to think about, and hopefully our listeners will work toward encouraging all pollinators and bumblebees specifically. For those of you joining us toward the end, this is KRFY Community Radio 88.5 FM, Panhandle Community Radio. This has been Julie Calamine, the morning show host for Community Conversations. And I want to thank you for listening, and we will talk again next week.